the 40th study of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 5th of July, 1977. Brother John Knowles, speaking to the subject, The Seven Vials, God's Judgment on Papal Rome, and the reading is taken from the Revelation, chapter 15.
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. We would like to open the meeting at study night this night to sing hymn number 198, followed with prayer. Hymn 198. Before we commence the class with the reading of Revelation 15, Brother John will give us his special exposition this week in Israel.
It's going to be very short tonight. I left the notes on my desk. Anyway, I know what the opening was going to be. Who's heard of the Histadrut? Just sort of put your hand up if you've heard of the Histadrut. One, two. Ah, well, I thought you mightn't have. Well, actually, the Histadrut is a very important organisation. The word Histadrut is a Hebrew word, which is the abbreviation, and I was going to give you the rest of it, but that wouldn't have meant anything anyway. It really means that it is the name for the Israel Labour Federation. Now, just after the elections for the Knesset, which we looked at last time, that is the Israel Parliament, there has been the elections for the Israel Labour Federation, which is known as the Histadrut. Now, this Histadrut is an organisation which is almost as powerful as the Knesset. Now, the elections which have taken place there have parties which are very similar to those which were in the Knesset. Now, remember last week we had a look at the parties which were represented in the Knesset as a result of the recent elections. And you remember we pointed out that for the first time in the history of the nation, there has been a change, inasmuch as the Labour alignment, which was previously in government from 1948 right down till this year, has now been toppled from the government and has been placed by this ultra-conservative right-wing party known as the Likud. And so the Likud, with 35.8% of the votes, was able to make a coalition with these other parties, the National Religious Party, Agudat, Shalom Zion, and they are still hopeful of getting the Democratic Movement for Change in with them, although they don't really need it. So what happened then was that the three major parties then are Likud, which controls the government, Labour, which is in opposition, and DMC, which really don't know which way they're going at the moment, but they're a brand new party and they haven't done badly. Well then, the Histadrut elections were held, and they have presented a different set of results. So that I've added in this week the percentage of the vote, so that Likud got 35.8% of the vote in the Knesset elections, but only 28.8% of the votes in the Histadrut elections. The Labour Party in the Knesset got 26.7% of the votes, but in the Histadrut elections got 54.6%. So they've got a majority in their own right. Now the Histadrut then, in a sense, is a bit like our ACTU, but it's even more powerful. There were 1,400,000 people who were eligible to vote in the Histadrut elections. That's about half the population of the State of Israel. Of those, something slightly in excess of 60% turned up and they voted. Now, there were other results as well. There were some other parties in it. Apart from those three, there was the New Communists who got 3%, the Religious Workers who got 1.8%, and the Independent Liberals who got 1.3%. But you can see that the two major contenders, leaving the DMC out for the moment, are Likud and Labour. But what we've got now is that we've got Likud dominating the Knesset and Labour dominating the Histadrut. So that a confrontation would seem to be almost inevitable. Both parties, or both groups we should say, both organisations, are vowing that they're going to try and get on with each other. But of course, you see, Labour missed out on getting into the Knesset, and they're not too happy about that. And so the Histadrut then is going to, in effect, become another opposition party, because they control not only all of the unions, but they also employ people, they also conduct quite a lot of social welfare programs. They also conduct a lot of educational programs. In a sense, they're almost like a mini-government. In fact, I think someone called them a quasi-Knesset. That means they're almost like the Knesset. They see themselves somewhat in that light. However, although Labour were pleased to get 54.6, it has been pointed out that up to the year 1965, Labour were getting in excess of 90% of the votes for the Histadrut regularly. And since then, it has gradually slipped off, and the Likud is coming up. Well, right, what does all that mean? Well, it means this, that there are a large number of people in the Israeli of the Israeli population who are becoming disenchanted with the Labour movement and are looking for a more conservative, right-wing type of government, which is going to take a harder line. They claim that particularly some of the underprivileged groups are looking for this sort of change. So these two recent elections, and they both take place every 4 years, both the Histadrut and the Knesset elections take place every 4 years, it looks like now there could be a confrontation, quite a strong one, between these two bodies. However, they're both saying that they will try and avoid it if possible, but only time will tell if such turns out to be the case. The other point as far as our interest in Israel is concerned this week is perhaps a little outside of Israel, but it's associated with Carter. And Carter is still making some very strong statements. We read recently in the paper that the Carter administration said that Israel would have to withdraw from the occupied West Bank of the Jordan River as part of a durable Middle East peace settlement, making clear the administration's differences with Israel's new Likud government. The State Department said that withdrawal would also have to encompass the Golan Heights of Syria, the Egyptian Sinai, and the Gaza Strip. Now, no American president has ever spoken in as strong terms as that before. So I think it's the case of extremes begetting extremes. The Americans see this liquid as an extreme movement who say we will not give up anything. And so they are reacting the other way, and they're virtually saying here, we want you to give up everything. So Israel looks like having some trouble, both in her own country, with the Histadrut now, who are quite opposed to the ruling power in the Knesset, and also to the new Carter administration, which looks like taking a particularly tough line with Israel. So Mr. Begin is trying to make out that he's not as inflexible as people think, and he says he's prepared to go to the Geneva conference without any preconditions. But nobody really believes him, because they think that deep down inside he says, I'm not going to give up anything anyway, but all I'm prepared to say is I will not place any preconditions on the conference. So it will be interesting to see the outcome of the attitude of America towards Israel, and also what the future will mean for these two bodies. So tonight's talk was principally centred around looking at this labour organisation. So if you hear about the Histadrut in future, don't just pass it off as a trade union. It is a very powerful organisation, and in some ways almost as powerful as the government itself.
Thank you, John. Now we'll ask Brother Jeff Lohman to come forth and read Revelation chapter 15.
Reading together Revelation chapter 15. And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvellous, seven angels having the seven last plagues. For in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvellous are thy works, Lord God Almighty, just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou art holy, for all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest. And after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. And the seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles. And one of the four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials, full of the wrath of God, who liveth for ever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled.
With this introduction, we arrive now of the subject, seven vials, God's judgments on papal Rome, and we will leave the class in the hand of Brother John Knowles.
Well, class members, we come now to the beginning of a new section, which commences in Revelation chapter 15 and verse 5. Unfortunately, we haven't got the notes available. They're very close to being finished. It's entirely my fault that they aren't finished. There's no one else to blame for it. Quite prepared to confess that. But we do hope, God willing, to have them out in the very, very near future. But we're aware of the fact, though, as we've seen from the chart, which we'll refer to now, which we had right back in volume one of the notes, that when we come to this key expression, such as we have here in chapter 15, verse 5, after that, or as Brother Thomas More literally translates it, after these things, I saw and behold the nave of the tabernacle, etc., it indicates to us that John is now going to commence a new section of the vision. And if you do happen to have volume one of the notes there, and you turn right back to the very first chart, you'll see the one that I've got projected up on the screen here, so that for those who are perhaps listening to the tape, it is in fact the very first chart in volume one. A chart entitled A Thematic Outline of the Apocalypse. So we have just concluded the section which went from chapter 7 verse 9 through to chapter 15 verse 4. And we're now going to commence the section which goes from chapter 15, verse 5, through to chapter 17, verse 18. That is, in fact, through to the end of chapter 17. So it encompasses chapters 15, 16, and 17, and it's going to involve the seven vials, God's judgments on papal Rome. So this key expression then tells us that we've come to this new section. Those of you, and I hope most of you have been able to do this, but those of you who've read the relevant section in Eureka will remember that Brother Thomas makes a great point of this particular expression, after these things, and he points out to us that although the expression there says after these things, it doesn't mean to say that that has to be interpreted in a chronological sense. Now, I think we're all quite aware of this, that we've become used to this theme now, that we are not looking at a book which is set out strictly chronologically, but a book which is set out thematically. So, as the Brother Thomas points out to us, and as we've seen from our own studies of this, what we're now being told is that John is now seeing another vision. He's not just seeing something which would take place after it. He's now going to see another vision. And whilst, in a sense, as we've seen from this particular chart here, there is a definite progression onwards, it's not a matter of saying that each step flows on like that, but rather that we go forward, then we come back. We go forward and we come back. We don't come right back to where we started, but we come back a certain way. And so it is with the vials, that the previous section had taken us right through to there. Now we come back, but we don't go back as far as the trumpets. We only go back as far as the period, which we shall see, of about the time of the French Revolution, or more particularly, the time of Napoleon. But, as we're going to see a little later this evening, the French Revolution and the work of Napoleon is a particularly interesting period of history. I'm going to do with a little bit of history tonight, and I think you'll find it interesting. It's a very, very interesting period, and very significant as far as this part of our study is concerned tonight. So, looking then at verse 5, we are told that after he had concluded that vision, which he'd seen in chapter 15, going through to verse 4, he now looks, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. Brother Thomas's translation, which we always use in our notes, translates it this way, that after these things I saw, and behold, the nave of the tabernacle of the testimony had been opened in the heaven. He points out to us that the tabernacle is one thing, but the nave of the tabernacle is another thing. Right? The tabernacle is one thing, the nave of the tabernacle is another. They are both, however, significant of a society of people and a state of things pertaining to them. Now, to remind ourselves of the difference between them, let's go back to this chart, which we're very familiar with. It's been circulated many times. It's also found in the Revelation notes, somewhere either in volume 2 or 3, I think. But it's the one entitled The Tabernacle, the Centre of Divine Worship in Israel. Now, in this particular verse, we are referred to the nave of the tabernacle. So, whilst the tabernacle can be that whole area there, it's the whole thing, or maybe even this section in here, the nave of the tabernacle is what we would generally call the most holy place. So, the nave of the tabernacle, or as it's translated in the Authorized Version, the temple of the tabernacle, is really the most holy place. So when we read this, then, we should see that after this, these things, John looked and he saw that the most holy place had been now opened. The most holy place of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. Now we know, don't we, from studying the symbology of this, that as far as we are concerned in this present dispensation, we are in the antitypical holy place. The three articles of furniture being the table of showbread, the lampstand, and the altar of incense. And that those three articles of furniture represent our life in the truth now. The lampstand represents the manifestation of the light of the truth as a result of the combustion of the oil of the word. The table of showbread represents that fellowship which one can only have with the Father when they have come in through that veil there as a result of partaking of the altar of sacrifice and the water of washing. And the other thing is the altar of incense, which represents that prayer and that communion which we can have with the Father, symbolised by the incense ascending to heaven. So, whereas then, the outer court of the tabernacle represents our approach through Christ, the holy place represents our position in Christ now, the most holy place, styled the nave, or in the authorised version, the temple of the tabernacle, represents immortality. Styled in the book of Hebrews, heaven itself, again used in a symbolical sense there. So when we read then in this particular verse that after these things he looked and he saw the nave of the tabernacle opened, it represents now a time of immortality. Brother Thomas makes the comment that the tabernacle or the holy place consists of the saints in their present, mixed and imperfect condition, blasphemed and trodden underfoot of the Gentiles. That's what we've just said. They are in their generations the tabernacle of the testimony, because they bear witness by the word for Jesus and the faith. Now the nave of the tabernacle is, as he says, the most holy. It consists of the one body freed from everything that defiles. It represents the saints clothed with immortality. Now when we come to the next chapter, in the next chapter, we're going to be particularly informed what the things are that are going to successively transpire in the development of this great and marvellous sign in the heaven before the nave is opened. So once again, we've got an outline of what the vision's going to be all about. The time setting for this vision will be the time when the tabernacle is opened in heaven. Sorry, the nave of the tabernacle is opened. In other words, the saints will be revealed in immortalized glory in the heavens, in the ruling heavens. And the chapter then is going to go on, rather chapter 16 is going to go on and show those events which are going to culminate in this particular thing taking place. You might say, well, how do we know we have to go back? Well, it becomes obvious as we go through the next few verses that we are shown how this state of affairs comes about. It's fairly self-explanatory. So verse 5 then speaks to us of the time when the saints will be raised and will be granted immortality. Now verse 6 speaks to us about the seven angels which came out of the temple. Now these seven angels are going to be involved in pouring out the seven vials of the wrath of God as described in chapter 16. Now remember, we've had the seven seals which spoke of God's judgments on pagan Rome. We've seen the seven trumpets, God's judgments on Catholic Rome. And we're now going to see the seven vials, which are God's judgments on that Roman system, which existed from the time of the French Revolution onwards, which we've styled Papal Rome. Because it was then a power which was principally only religious. Prior to that time, it had a lot of temporal power. From the French Revolution onwards, it lost most of its temporal power. Didn't lose all of its temporal power, because the Catholic Church still held those three papal states in Italy. Those papal states which divided northern Italy from southern Italy, and as a result of which the popes successfully divided Italy into three sections, and that temporal power wasn't lost until 1870. Just wondering, are you familiar with the situation in Italy? Because this is fairly important. Prior to the Unicode, perhaps you're not. Perhaps it won't hurt just to spend a minute briefly speaking on this. If I can just find I'll use the bottom half of this one here to briefly describe it. If I can draw a map of Italy. Where's the footgate? Goes down that way, doesn't it? Alright, that's Italy. Ireland, Sicily out there. Now, prior to 1870, there was no such a thing as a unified Italy. We sort of think of Italy as always being Italy, but it wasn't always that way. In the middle here, there were three states which were known as the Papal States. Down in the south here was an area known as the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. The Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, and in the north was the area of northern Italy, comprising Piedmont and Lombardy. Now, the Piedmontese and the Lombardians, they were more akin to the French and the Austrians and the Swiss, whose countries border on northern Italy. Consequently, even today, we talk about northern Italians, and we expect them to be taller and fairer and generally better educated. The southern Italians, however, are more Mediterranean. They are generally shorter, they are darker, they are swarthier, and they are generally less educated, shall we say more illiterate, in some ways more backward. This has been the result of the papal states effectively dividing Italy into three sections, but principally two sections, northern Italy and southern Italy. Now, it wasn't until 1870, with the work of Garibaldi and Victor Emmanuel and people like this, that the papal states were destroyed, at least they were destroyed as a papal possession. The Pope got the huff, of course, and he said, well, I'm going to remain a prisoner in the Vatican, and he was confined simply to the Vatican State, a small area of only a few acres, which is his only possession now. So since 1870, the Pope has had no temporal power. So when we talk about the temporal power of the papacy coming into an end in 1870, we're talking about the loss of the papal states. But really, prior to that time, around about the French Revolution, which was, you know, the end of the 1700s, the Pope had tremendous control over a whole area of Europe. And the French Revolution and the work of Napoleon effectively took that away. So that's why I said earlier that the Pope lost most of his power just after the French Revolution. But I thought, in case someone says, hey, I thought the temporal power of the papacy went in 1870, the answer is yes, you're right, because he finally lost those three states and he retained simply the Vatican. As I said, he got the huff and he said, well, I'm going to remain a prisoner in the Vatican for the rest of my days. The popes successfully maintained that stand up until 1929. That's about 60 years. And then they finally found that that wasn't effective, so they signed the Lateran treaties, and the Pope magnanimously agreed not to remain a prisoner in the Vatican anymore. I don't know what effect that had on anybody, but really that's the way it went. Now, where are we? Well, we're talking then about this period of history which starts immediately after the French Revolution and the period of Napoleon, and we're going to see then that the judgments which are going to be poured out will be on that Roman system, which became very much reduced in power as a result of the revolution and the work of Napoleon. Principally a religious power with very little temporal power at all. Temporal power meaning power of a political nature. All right, well, that was a little aside, but I think it will be somewhat helpful when we come in a few moments to these early verses of chapter 16. All right, well, we've got then in verse 6 of chapter 15, the seven angels which came out of the temple having the seven plagues. And they were clothed in pure and white linen, and they have their breasts girded with golden girdles. There's an easy way of handling that verse, which some expositors do, by simply saying that the seven angels represent angels, and they would quote Hebrews chapter 1 and say that the angels are ministering spirits sent forth by God to minister on behalf of them who are the heirs of salvation. If I said that and left the verse behind, maybe 99% wouldn't know the difference, and they'd say, well, that was a nice, convenient, easy exposition. But it's not right, and it's certainly not what Brother Thomas says in Eureka, but it's a very, very tricky verse, and I really almost was tempted to just gloss over the verse. Brother Thomas says in Eureka, and we'll try and follow this as closely as we can. If you've got Eureka there, you can follow exactly what he says. Brother Thomas points out in Eureka that the seven angels represent the saints. You'll find this on page 459 of volume 3 of Eureka, if you happen to have it there. He points out that the seven angels are the saints. All right. Now let me present the difficulties. There are two difficulties. If the seven angels are the saints, how come the first five angels pour out their vials before the time of the resurrection? Because you know the sixth vial, and we all know the sixth vial, if we don't know anything about any of the others, we all know the sixth vial, that's the drying up of the Euphrates, isn't it? And that's the resurrection period. How come then the first five angels can pour out their vials before the resurrection? That's the first difficulty. And the second one is, if the angels are the saints, then who are the four beasts of verse 7? Well, we say they're the saints. Well, how come one of the four beasts gives the vials unto the angels? You can't have the saints giving it to the saints. Now, because of those difficulties, I think some decide to come up with an easier alternative and say, well, look, the seven angels are the angels and the four beasts are the saints, and that's it. Well, it's not it. Not at all. All right, well, let's try and answer the question. If Brother Thomas points out that the seven angels are the saints, he also points out later on that some of these angels are such things as the British power, for example. He makes the comment, I think I can pick up the comment on page 461. Perhaps I won't try and pick up his actual words, but I'll paraphrase what he says. You might find that a little bit easier anyway. As far as the angels are concerned, we mustn't fall for the trap of trying to specify and to categorize these symbols into any individual or group of individuals. You know, we've pointed this out several times, that the book of Revelation is not so much trying to tell us how God is going to do it, or necessarily specifically through whom he's going to do it, but the principles by which it's going to be done. Now let's take this word, the saints. Soon as I said it refers to the saints, and certainly the way I said it would have helped to confuse, I suppose everybody immediately thought of those who are the brethren of Christ and will be raised from the dead. But the word saints is used in other ways in the Bible. Weren't the Medes and the Persians God's saints in Isaiah? Didn't he raise them up to perform a particular work? Wasn't Cyrus his anointed? So a saint then is a separated one. And whilst Brother Thomas points out that the seven angels represent the saints, it is not the saints of Christ or the brethren of Christ until the sixth vial, but that there are other saints involved in the pouring out of the first five vials, and that these can include, and I have got a quote here, if I can put my finger on it fairly quickly, which summarises his thoughts on this matter. Yes, here it is. The living one, incorporate in the saints, gives judgment to the seven angels, which, to show their relation to the saints in judicial operation, are represented as receiving the golden vials of wrath from one of the four living ones, which undoubtedly represents the saints. That's the saints of chapter 5. The wrath of the seven golden vials is not poured out in all its details by the saints. That is, by those who are the brethren of Christ. The 16th chapter shows this. It shows that five vials are entirely exhausted, and much of the sixth, before the one of the four living ones, that is Christ and the saints, appear upon the scene. Now he says, the word of Yahweh to Zerubbabel was, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit. The spirit is the girder or the strengthener. You see, this is a play upon the word in verse 6 that says their breasts were girded with golden girdles. That's a symbol that they were strengthened. Now, the Spirit is the girder or strengthener. Whether, he says, it be Cyrus, Alexander, Constantine, Alaric, Attila, Genseric, the British power, Napoleon, or the saints. So you see, anybody that God sets apart for his purpose is a saint. It can be a Cyrus, it can be an Alaric, an Attila, it can be the British Navy, or it can be a Napoleon. So when we read here that the seven angels are the saints, in Brother Thomas's exposition of Eureka, he's telling us that the seven angels represent whoever or whatever power God sets apart at a special time to perform a specific work. And I feel that the difficulty has come in not reading Eureka closely enough. And, you know, you've got to read it very closely. I've got to read it closely. And I had to read this several times to try and see what he was saying. So that the saints, then, of the first five vials are not the saints. We'll talk about the saints in order to distinguish them from the saints. All right? So, Cyrus was one of the saints. But the brethren of the Lord are the saints, all right? So the first five vials were poured out by the saints. But the sixth one is going to be part of the work, or part of the sixth one is going to be the work of the saints, and certainly the seventh one. So when we come in a few moments to consider each of these first five vials in turn, we're going to see, as Brother Thomas says, that the British upon the sea and the French upon the land were girded in their operations against the worshippers of the beast and his image in the first five vial periods, on the same principle that Cyrus was girded by the Spirit for the overthrow of the dominion of Babylon and for the punishment of the worshippers of Baal. The four living ones and the seven angels, apart from the Spirit who energizes them, are as nothing. The wrathful power of the great and marvelous sign in the heaven is golden because just and true, and faithful. This is supreme and righteous. Its agents are subordinate and not necessarily pure and holy. The power being the same seven spirit power, though the agents employed are diverse in the outpouring of all of the seven vials, these are all said to be given to the seven angels, although the saints do not come upon the arena till toward the close of the sixth vial period. Now let's go back then to verse 6 and try and see how this fits into what we're saying. We're finding then in verse 6 that the seven angels came out of the temple having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles. Now, if we've just said that the nave represents immortality, and we've now perhaps convinced everybody that these seven angels don't have to be the saints, but that it can be Napoleon and the British, how come they're coming out of the nave? Well, no problem. It's all God manifestation, isn't it? It's all God manifestation. The Lord Jesus Christ and his Father are now part of that nave, and so are those angels who are the ministering spirits. Therefore, if the deity out of that nave issues forth a command that the British are to defeat Napoleon on the sea, or something like that, then that effectually is coming out of the nave. So that the angels, these angels, whether it be a Napoleon or a Cyrus or whatever, is quite powerless in his own right. He is not an angel in his own right. He is not a messenger in his own right. He's only a messenger when the spirit of deity motivates him. And if the spirit of deity raises up a Cyrus, then that Cyrus becomes an angel, and because motivated by the deity, effectively comes out of the nave. I'll leave that for a minute just to digest. But I don't really think it's all that difficult when we take it step by step. And providing we keep reminding ourselves that we are reading a book which is completely different from every other book. It's a book which is setting out the principles of God manifestation. So at the risk of being tedious with the point, let's just go through that step by step again. Verse 5, after concluding that vision, John looks and he now sees the nave of the tabernacle opened in the heavens. So he's looking into the ultimate vision of immortality. But he now sees seven angels coming out of this nave. So whilst he's looking to the time when the nave will be completely opened, the nave which at present exists, where the Lord Jesus Christ and his Father dwell, sends forth these angels. They don't come physically from his presence, but inasmuch as that spirit comes forth to motivate them, they are therefore the ambassadors of deity, they are therefore the angels, and they are therefore girded by his spirit. Even as Brother Thomas points out, they might have been quite, I forget what the term was, but it doesn't imply any moral, well there he is, he says, not necessarily do they have to be pure and holy. The spirit that drives them is that. And as ambassadors of the deity, they come in his name. But those individuals themselves may not be such. In case that worries you, look at it this way. We talk about the Holy Land, don't we? What's holy about the land of Israel? God made it holy. He set it apart. We talk about certain holy vessels in the tabernacle. What was holy about those vessels? They had no morals. It was just that God set them apart. We talk about the nation of Israel as being a holy nation, but they were quite wayward and quite wicked. That didn't stop them being a holy nation. So Cyrus can be holy, even though he might be quite immoral. And so these angels then can be described as being clothed in pure and white linen and having their breasts girded with golden girdles, because God has constituted them holy, and that these symbols represent holiness. I told you this verse was a one we'd have to battle with, and you can see perhaps why some just gloss over it and say, well, let's make the angels, and go on with the next verse. But you can also perhaps see the point why I didn't want to dodge it, and because if you have read this section in Eureka, it may be that you've had some difficulty in working out how come Brother Thomas is on one page that the seven angels are the saints, and on the next page he starts talking about the British power and all such things as that. Well, that, I believe, is the reason why he does so. I'm prepared to stop at that stage if someone would like to ask a question in case it's not clear. Is there anything there that you'd like me to go through again, or, you know, you can disagree with it and say it doesn't sound right? But I think I'm representing Brother Thomas's mind on that, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm quite sure that's what the verse is talking about. No questions on it? Yeah, yes, Alan. Yeah, that's right.